Is gather patients. So 20 minutes late was our purpose to connect to patients. No quiet, and some fellowship together. So now I'm going to, what am I going to do? I'll just get on and do it. No introduction necessary yet. But this is especially part of this little book tour which I'm doing throughout Canada and the US, simply because some of these teachings which we have in one of the world's great religions, Buddhism, are so valuable that it's too good to keep secret. So today you're going to hear the secret teachings of Buddhism. And these teachings are not something esoteric, which is hard for people to understand, but something simple, down to earth, which increases people's happiness and peace, which creates harmony in this world, let alone any future worlds. So the whole point of these teachings, especially in my little book, is in order to increase people's spirituality, their happiness, so they can live together without too many problems. And the reason I say this is because as a monk, not only are you a meditator, a meditation teacher, you're also a counselor. People come to you with their problems. And the reason why people like to visit monks to answer their problems is because monks are cheap. We never charge anything. Indeed, many years ago, this woman called up one of our monks and said, "I hear you teach meditation." She wanted some meditation instructions. He said, yes, madam, I teach meditation. In fact, he was one of the famous meditation teachers of our tradition. And so she said, how much do you charge per session? He replied, nothing, madam, it is for free. And then she said, if it's for free, you can't be any good then, and put down a note. So these days we never say it is for free, we say it is priceless. And these are indeed priceless teachings. Because I got all this stuff for free, from my teachers, from my life. Why should you charge anyone else for it? This little book here, I get nothing from it, it all goes to the publishers and other people. But nevertheless, these are great teachings which help solve problems in life. I wrote that book because someone begged me, literally, to please write that book, to put these stories there for wider publication. It saved this lady's life going through a divorce. She said, please, can you write about brothers? And so that's what I did. So, for example, one of my favourite stories in this book is the story of the two bad dreams. I don't know if I told the story. When did I tell the story before? Good story. Okay, thank you. It's a great story. Even when I was in Birkin yesterday, I was just up in Kamloops, a couple of people, when I was signing their books, said that was the one story which stood out and changed their life. And it did change my life as well. But spirituality, religion, shouldn't be something you just go to a temple or a church and you go out afterwards just feeling holy and then go and to argue with your partner. The whole purpose of religion or spirituality is to change your life for the better. And this is one of those stories which do change your life. That's why it's number one story in this book. When I started my monastery, I'm from Australia, that's where my monastery is. When I started this monastery, we had no money. We were really poor. In fact, we had to borrow money to buy this land, and there was no buildings on this land at all. So for the first few days, I had to sleep out under the trees. I learned what it was like to be a kangaroo. That's what I slept through. Really cold. And when we did get any funds, while we were still paying off the debt for buying the land, any donations and funds which we did get were all had to be used for building materials. Later on, we had all these lovely stories to try and get donations, and this is one of the stories which we use. If any of you want to raise funds for any cause, this is a great story. It's a story of the hungry spider. Did I tell that story? Where did I tell that one? Once upon a time, there was this really thin, hungry, pathetic, depressed, suicidal spider. The reason why he was in such a desperate state, every time he made a little web in a corner of somebody's house, because his web was his home. That's where spiders live. Every time he made a web, somebody took a broom and destroyed it. He never had a chance even to have 1 hour in his house for rest, let alone have any time to catch some food to eat. Every house he went to, he very carefully built a web, and some person bashed it apart, smashed it up, and he had to go and make another one. Room after room, house after house, so often he just finished his new home, and someone destroyed it. He was so tired, so frustrated, but more importantly, so hungry, he never caught one fly for days, for weeks. So this poor spider was was struggling, staggering along the streets of Vancouver. A sorry sight to see. He was homeless. no friends, no one loved him. He was so hungry. And when he was crying, he passed by this very fat spider. This very fat and jolly spider who was sunning himself outside the house. And the fat spider looked at the suicidal spider and said, "Oh, what's wrong with you?" And the suicidal spider said, "Oh, life is so hard. Life is so difficult. I can't even find a home. These human beings are so cruel. They always destroy my home before I have a chance to eat anything. I'm so hungry and so lonely." And the fat spider said, "Oh, you poor thing. Why did you come and stay with me? In my place, no one ever disturbs my web, and I catch lots of things to eat. You come and stay with me." And the thin suicidal spider was really quite surprised. "That looks like a house to me. How come that no one disturbs your web? How come you always have time to catch things to eat?" And this fat spider said, "Oh, I live in the donation box of a Buddhist temple. No one ever disturbs me." Change that to a church, or to your rotary club, or to your school, or whatever. It's a great way to get donations. First of all, religion should be fun. Spirituality should give you a smile. But anyway, serious business. When I first started this monastery in Australia, 22 years ago, didn't have any money. You can get some building materials. In that part of the world, there's so many white ants, you have to build out of bricks. So there I was, having been, I was a theoretical physicist and a school teacher before. I wasn't used to using my hands. Now you have to learn how to mix concrete, lay bricks, put on a roof, plumbing, anything. Laying bricks is not easy. You try it. You put some mortar down, you've got to make the brick level and in line. One corner is always too high. You tap that one down and another corner goes up. You tap that corner down and it goes out of line. You tap it back into line and that first corner is high again. So it is very frustrating. But the one thing with a monk, like I told you when I first came in here, because I was saying, we have patience. Doesn't matter how long it takes, you keep on going until it's perfect. Every brick had to be perfect before I went on to the next one. When I finished my first brick wall, I was so happy until I looked at it. Only then did I notice I'd missed two bricks. Every other brick was level. These two bricks were at an angle. I couldn't believe that I'd missed these. And I was so careful. But these bricks were at a terrible angle. They ruined the effect of the whole wall. The wall of the mess. Well, that was some amateur job. I was an amateur, but I didn't think that way at the time. First response was to try and scrape the cement mortar out to take the bricks out so I could sort of put them in again, but it was too hard. So then I thought that maybe we can get some dynamite, blow it up and start again. I wanted to destroy the wall. Because I was embarrassed, upset at my obvious failure. The other monks were not allowed to blow it up. I had to keep it there. And for 3 months I suffered. Literally, every time I thought of that war, I thought of my two mistakes. I'd really blown it, stuffed up big time. Every time a visitor would come, I'd try and be the one to take them around. So I could always take them somewhere else so they would never see my terrible brick wall. I was embarrassed about what I'd done and how much of a mess I'd made. But one day I was with a visitor, they saw that wall and what they said changed a lot of my life. They said it was a beautiful wall. I replied, "Are you visually impaired?" "How come you can't see those two bad bricks? You left some glasses in the car or something?" And they said, "Yes, I can see the two bad bricks, but I could also see the 998 good bricks as well." And to me, that changed my whole perception of the wall. For 3 months, every time I thought of that wall,
I only saw my mistakes. Every time I passed it by, my eyes would go to the two bad bricks. I was literally blind to anything else other than my two mistakes. When someone pointed out to me that above, below, to the left, to the right of my two mistakes were many, many, many more perfect bricks, then I could see them all. When I saw the whole wall, I had to agree with that guy. It wasn't that bad. But when I focused on my two mistakes, it was so terrible, I wanted to destroy the whole thing. Then I realized that that is the truth of much of our life. You may go to work. One bad thing happens to you that day, and the 998 good things which happen to you, you completely forget. One thing spoils your whole day. One bad word spoils your whole relationship. This is a companion story to this. I was in Malaysia teaching, like I'm doing here, question time, the lady put her hand up. The question was some free counseling. They knew it was some free, that's why they asked me. My husband has just lied to me. I can't trust him anymore. Shall I get divorced? Fair question. Because a relationship depends upon trust, isn't it? They found a husband who lied to them. Can't trust him anymore. Should I get divorced? So before answering, I wanted some more information. What are you doing? What's your job? She was actually a lecturer in math. So that actually opened up an avenue to answer her question. I said, how long have you been married to that guy? She said, 3 years. I said, okay, let's do some statistics together. 3 years of marriage, let's call that 1,000 days. Let's assume that every day your husband has said 20 things which could be right, which could be wrong. That since you've been married, he said 20,000 things which could be truthful, which could be lies. Now he's lied to you for the first time. According to probability theory, that means the next time he opens his mouth, there's a 20,000-to-1 chance he's telling the truth. What do you mean you can't trust him? Now, when I put it that way, can't you see that sometimes one lie does not make a person untrustworthy? But if that's all we see, the one lie, then of course we can't trust them. We want to destroy the whole relationship. We could have been friends with somebody since the time we were at school. They do one thing which upsets us. It is a bad thing. Yeah, we're not denying that. But why allow one bad, stupid act, one bad trick, to destroy the whole wall of your friendship together? Why allow one lie, when it's been 20,000 truths, to destroy your marriage? Now you can understand the power of that simile. Because it illustrates a little way that many human beings think, which is not a rational nor a good way, a way which actually makes it hard for people to live together. How many people get divorced because of two bad bricks? Okay, maybe four or five bricks, but it's still many good bricks. Because we always tend to focus on the faults, not on the good things. And this is actually part of training a mind in positive states. Buddhism is the religion above all which trains your mind with meditation, with wisdom, to see good things, not just in others, but also in life, also in yourself. In life, one of the biggest causes of pain for human beings is the death of a loved one. I was fortunate to have spent many years as a young monk in Thailand, in a village which had not been touched by Western civilization. It was a traditional Thai village. Moreover, the monastery was a local cremation ground for the villagers around. So I was immersed in a culture very foreign from any Western, witnessing funerals at least once a week, sometimes twice. And the strange thing which I noticed over 9 years, I could not see any grief in the relations of people who die. You see these villagers every day. In the morning when I was around, they come to the temple, they talk to you. Even they left, they would lose their children, their husband, wife, parents, sometimes in tragic situations. They never had grief. And that shocked me. What I found from that basic anthropological, whatever it's called, little study over 9 years, that grief is something we add on to loss. It's not essential. And in fact, I must have been a Buddhist in a previous life because I too did not have grief. It wasn't part of my emotional makeup. Even when my own father died, I did not cry at his funeral, nor did I cry afterwards, even though I loved that man very much, and he was a great inspiration to me. I'll tell you some stories about my father later. But it took me a long time to understand the emotions of a son at his father's funeral. He died when I was only 16. Why didn't I cry? Why didn't I mourn his loss? And to understand what I was going through, I had to find a story. I like describing things in stories, because really, stories are the unit of human existence. You don't live a life of ideas. Your life is a series of interwoven stories. Sometimes those stories intersect with your friends and loved ones. But that is your life, a series of stories. So when I talk in stories, I'm talking in the basic unit of human experience. So this was a story which allowed me to express some innermost feelings of the loss of my father. And it's a story which I tell at every funeral which I take as a Buddhist monk, and which has inspired me people so much that on one occasion, after telling this story, the funeral director came up to me and he said, I'm not exaggerating, he said, I'm a funeral director, I organize funerals every day, that is about 20, 30 years. That's the best funeral I've ever attended. That was praise to the professionals. And he added, when I die, can you do my funeral for me? I really treasure that. The story which impressed him was the way I explained my feelings when my father died. Even though I loved him very much, I never cried. This is why. I used the simile of a concert. Even though that I now live in Australia, I was brought up in London. I was born in 1951. So when I was very young, I used to go to the clubs of pubs, the concert halls in London, to listen to music. I loved every type of music, from classical to jazz, from folk to rock. I remember some amazing experiences. I remember hearing the very first concert of Led Zeppelin in the Marquee Club in Soho, when they were just so nervous. And those of you who know Led Zeppelin, Jimmy Page was just missing all his notes. They later became world famous. I also remember just going to a pub in the north of London, and such a small number of audience, I think there's only 6 of us turned up. I was one, my brother was number 2, and about 4 others. I never expected the band to actually play, but they did. Just the 6 of us. The lead singer was a guy called Rod Stewart. In his early days. So I have these amazing memories of my life growing up in London, going to concerts. For those of you who've been to London, know in the evening it's very cold, wet and miserable. So when the concert was finished, like everybody else, you'd stand up, clap and shout for more. Usually the band or orchestra, they'd always play a little bit more. But then would come the time when an orchestra or band would have to pack up their instruments and go home. And so did I. And even though I went out from that concert hall into the cold, dark gloom of a London night, even though I knew the concert was over and I probably would never hear that band or orchestra again, never once did I cry after a great concert. I never felt sad. What I felt was how wonderful that was to who have been there at such a magnificent performance. How inspiring and moving that music was. And I always will remember that music to the end of my days. How privileged I was to be part of a wonderful performance. And that describes so accurately how I felt when I walked out of the crematorium in Mortlake, just south of the Thames in West London, after my father's funeral. What a wonderful performance that had been. What great times we shared together, like the great music. I wouldn't have given that up for the world. I went home, inspired, not crying, grateful for the 16 years we shared, and not at all thinking about anything to be taken away from me. That's how I viewed a funeral, a death. How wonderful that was. How grateful I was. So I never felt like crying at all. I felt inspired. Can you see? Instead of looking at the two bad bits, instead we look at the 998 good bits. And the two bricks as well. We see the bigger picture. And that bigger picture gives us a sense, not of crying, but this beauty and inspiration that is our life. When I tell that story, people get so happy that they didn't cry at somebody's funeral. Because do you want people to cry at your funeral? Or do you want people to respect your life? To be grateful for the time you share together, but not to take sadness away from your life. It seems a different way of looking at things, and that's what religion is supposed to be doing. Giving you more options on how to deal with some of the big problems of our life. This is what we mean about when there's nothing to do. Do nothing. At a funeral service, cry does not bring anyone back, but respecting them, enjoying the moment, seeing the beauty in everything is something which is really positive. So, in spirituality, in Buddhism, we try and look at the beautiful, even in the most difficult of situations. Which is why I think, I'm not quite sure I did have a chance to pause and see the title of this talk. I remember getting an email, I don't know what you're talking about, never do, who cares? I think the talk was something about every garden needs some dirt or something, wasn't it? This is the gardens here, every garden needs some dung. The only reason why you've got beautiful gardens here is because of the dung which went into this garden. And this is actually the title of this book, you can see it here. Who ordered this truckload of dung? That's the part of the book. And people sometimes ask, why did you call the book that title? And the reason I've titled the book that way is because it describes an essential story within that book. And again, this is one of those stories which I remember in Toronto a few days ago, one of the doctors saying that is a story which he tells all his patients. He said that is a story which shapes them, changes the way they look at their life, and actually heals their inner pain. Who ordered this truckload of dung goes like this. Life is sometimes unpleasant. Life is like this. You come from a morning talk and breakfast, dinner, whatever you call it, have a wonderful time. But when you go home, you find that somebody has dumped a whole truckload of cow shit in front of your house. The reason why I use the word cow shit is because the Buddha said in his teachings that the Dhamma, the teaching, should be put in the local language. That's why I use it. So, there's two things about the cow shit in front of your house. Number one, you did not order it. And number two, no one saw it coming, so you can't ring up the factory or the company to order them to take it away. You are stuck with it. In this simile, the cow shit dumped in front of your house is an awful experience you have to face in life. Separation. Partner says, I don't love you anymore, and runs away with your best friend or something. You get sacked from work. You go to the doctor and the biopsy comes through, you've got a cancer. You lose all your money in the stock market. There was a month. I've been away from my monastery for 3 weeks. It's supposed to be 21 months, so I go back to my monastery and find it all gone. Whatever happens. Sometimes life is very painful. And when you have these traumas in your life, first of all, you never ordered it. You think, why me? It could be a hurricane or it could be a tsunami. Why? The point is, you don't order these things. And number two, no, you can't call up somebody to take it away. Sure, your friends might try and help you if you've got sort of a separation, or your partner's been really unfaithful to you big time. But no one can help you. You see what I mean by the fact that I've done. You never ordered it, you're stuck with it. And my goodness, it stinks. However, continuing the metaphor, the story, there's two things which people do with cow shit. The first thing they do is they put it in their bags, in their pockets, up their shirt, down their trousers, and they take it around with them. You find if you carry around cow shit, you lose a lot of friends. In that scenario, what we mean is when these things happen to you in your life, you get negative, depressed, angry. Your friends will look after you for a while if you get very angry and depressed at the vicissitudes of life. But after a while, they can't stand you. You can only stand so much grumpiness. We always, by our nature, like to live with happy people or like to associate with happy people. After a while, you do tend to lose a lot of your friends if you get negative to the problems of life. However, there's another way you can deal with dung, with cow shit. Get out the wheelbarrow and the spade, move it round the back and dig it in your garden. That's hard work. And sometimes when you're in these situations, it's as much as you can do to do half a barrel a week. But at least you're doing something. At least that way, day after day, week after week, year after year, the pile of dung in front of your house gets less and less and less. And the garden in your back gets more and more fruitful and beautiful. And one day, for sure, a so-called miracle happens. The pile of dung of cow shit is gone. And you go around the back of your house and you've got this amazing fruit on your apple trees. So plentiful, it's bending down for you to pick. You share it with yourself, with all of your friends and loved ones. It's the sweetest fruit you can ever taste. And the flowers in your garden are more plentiful and fragrant. Their scent wafts down the street, even passes by. Enjoy the fragrance of your garden. You know that's all come from the cow shit which has now been changed to fertilizer. Through digging in the bad experiences of your life, learning from them, growing from them, digging them in, rather than rejecting them, you're digging the beautiful flowers of wisdom, the beautiful fruit of compassion. So much so, because you've been there, you've been through the cancer, you've been through the separation, you've been through even the domestic violence, that you can say to somebody else, going through the very same thing, I know. I know not only what you're going through, but I also know the way out, the path to freedom, as I've been there and I've done it. What a wonderful hope you can be for those others were suffering that same torment. That's what I mean by compassionate wisdom. You don't learn wisdom in a book. You don't learn compassion just by listening to talks like this all day. Compassionate wisdom, most of it comes from the experiences of your life. When you learn to dig in the unpleasantness and not look upon it as some terrible experience you just have to endure, but you learn from it, you grow from it, you transcend it, and out of it, you grow this incredible wisdom and compassion. This is one of my, I've noticed this, that some of the people which I've known in my monastic life, some of the great meditators are so peaceful, but they never become great teachers, simply because they never had enough suffering, enough done in their life to really grow compassion and wisdom. For those of you who've had a hard time, a difficult life, you're the ones with the most fertilizer, the ones which can grow the greatest compassion and wisdom. So the moral of that story is, whenever something terrible happens to you in life, whenever you have a great trauma, you should say, whoopee, well done for my God. That is how we should regard the problems of our life. And what this really is just extending this wisdom to what understanding, what real love, what real compassion is all about. Thank you for opening the bottle, and it comes up to another opening story, opening the door of my heart, because in the English or the Australian version of this book, this is actually a US edition, and the Australian edition was called Open the Door of Your Heart. That was considered too mushy for a US market. So they wanted to order this type of advice. You know what US people like. So, the reason why the Australian version was called Open the Door of Your Heart, and I mentioned I was going to tell you a story of my own father. This was how I learned the meaning of love, real love, from my father. Strange thing. We think we know what love means. But why is it, do you think, that when you have a child, you will love that child no matter what they ever do? Even though you don't know where that child has come from. You don't choose your child. You don't say, I'm going to have a child that is a good boy, does well at school, who's going to become a lawyer like me when he grows up, whatever it is. You just get stuck with this being that comes into your life. You don't know where from. No matter what they turn out like, you'll always love them. They're your son, they're your daughter. But why, on the other hand, is it when you choose a partner, right? You pay so much care in choosing your partner. You even pay more attention, you do more work, more research than when you buy a car. You find out the different models available, first of all. And very often with a partner these days, you test drive them before you commit. And even with all that testing and trying, when you do commit and you marry them, you still don't love them like your children. They're still not unconditional. Even though you chose them, you researched them, why can't you love your partner the same way you love a child? Interesting. But what do you mean by loving a child? When I was about 13, in a poor street of London, in my father's beat-up old car, he stopped the car, turned around to me, and said something, which again, one of these moments which changed your life. He said to me, son, wherever you go, whatever you do in your life, please remember this. The door of my house will always be open to you. Wherever you go, whatever you do, the door of my house will always be open to you. You're my son. And that's enough. Remember that clearly. But I also remember that as a 13-year-old, I couldn't really understand what it meant. All I knew, it was important. And so later on, when I became a monk at 23, I had the time to remember these things and think about them. I reflected and understood what he really meant to say. But his house was like a government apartment. He was a very poor man. In fact, we were so poor that we used to leave the door of our apartment open, hoping a burglar would come in, take pity on us, and leave something. So when he said the door of my house or apartment is open, he didn't really mean very much. But of course, that's not what he really intended to say. What he really meant to say was, son, whatever you do, wherever you go, the door of my heart will always be open to you. You're my son. My love for you is unconditional. No strings attached. Wherever you go, I will always love you. The door of my heart will always be open to you, my son. It is one of the most beautiful expressions of unconditional love and acceptance. And even as a 13-year-old, that meant so much to me. There was one person in this world I wouldn't have to do anything. I wouldn't have to achieve anything to have his love. It was given to me freely. And that really made so much sense to me as a monk. I've used that saying, that expression, so often to describe what we really mean by unconditional love. To say to someone close to us, maybe husband, wife, child, friend, whatever you do, wherever you go, wherever you are, whatever you become, the door of my heart is always open to you. My love for you is unconditional, free, not demanding anything. I just love you, that's all. And that took the idea of love to a great high level, the spiritual level. And I've encouraged my disciples in Australia, those who are in a partnership, to say that to your partner with full sincerity. Darling, I decided to live with you and choose you as my partner for this life. Whatever you do, wherever you go, the door of my heart is open to you. My love for you is unconditional. Some people objected, saying, if I do that to my partner, that's given them free rein to do whatever they want anyway. You know what I mean by whatever. But the experience is, it does not work that way. When my father gave me a blank check to do whatever I wanted, and though it came from the heart, there's no way in the world would I ever hurt such a person. I appreciated unconditional love. It was so rare a gift. No way in the world would I spoil that. I had to work harder to live up to such a person who would give me love so freely. And that's what you'll find if you give it up to your partner. They won't abuse such trust. It can't be. That's just too holy. What they will do is work harder to live up to that person who gives them love so freely. However, it goes further than that. Sometimes it happens when your partner is close to death. It seems so often that you love that person, you think you love them so much, you will not let them go into death. That's why even at death, if you tell your partner, it can be a son, a father, a loved one, darling, dear father, dear mother, the door of my heart is open to you, no matter what you ever do, even if you die. My love will free you, whatever you wish to do, and always love you. This is the difference between attached love, which sometimes happens at these last moments of life, when the person's about to die and you don't let them go. That is not love, that is attachment. You should love your loved ones, it could be your young wife, your young child, enough to be able to let them go. That's why the counseling a person when they're about to die in a Buddhist way, I always encourage the family in the last day or two before the person dies to please go up to them and give them permission to die. Seen this many times, on one occasion there's this young couple, he could have only been in his early 30s. She, Jenny, was in her about a year or two younger. Two young people enjoying their life. He got cancer, couldn't heal it, he was about to die. Seeing him for the last couple of days. I went to see them once in a little apartment in Perth. I saw what the problem was, so I told Jenny, have you told Dave? Have you given him permission to die yet? To her credit, she understood what I meant straight away. Without asking any questions, she jumped up on the bed. She hugged her husband and said, darling, I give you freedom to die. Let go. The door of my heart is open to you, no matter where you go, no matter what you do. If your body means, your life means, it's going to die, you go with my love and my freedom. It's one of the most touching times of my counseling career, where the two of them hugged. And at that moment, they really said goodbye, even though he died only maybe a day and a half later. What a beautiful time of love that is, when you can let a person who's so important to you, give them the freedom to die. Sometimes such love has unintended, unexpected rather, results. Because we had one of our monks. He was an American monk, a Rhodes Scholar from Tennessee, a champion wrestler, who when he was in Thailand, got typhoid. Two strains at the same time. Really, really sick. To cut a long story short, even though medical intervention stopped him from dying, they never really cured him. So he sent him to England, to our monastery there, we thought to get better medical treatment. And there, every type of medical treatment you can imagine, homeopathy, allopathy, aromapathy, every pathy except psychopathy, they gave him. Nothing worked. For about 3 years, he was on the edge of life and death. He'd been in this attic room on the top of this big house, which was our monastery in the south of England. I went to visit him a couple of times, and there was just like this really sickly, poor monk who'd once been a champion wrestler. He'd been in bed for weeks at a time. He started to feel better and started to get out of bed and go for a walk, only make it to the door before he collapsed in weakness. He'd been like that for about 3 years. And one day the abbot of this monastery had this beautiful insight. He went up to this poor monk's room and just stood by his bedside and said these words. He said, I've come up here on behalf of all the monks and nuns in this monastery, on behalf of all the laymen and laywomen who support me. Even your friends and family are not here. On behalf of them all, I've come up here to give you permission to die. You don't have to get well. And that, this Rhodes Scholar, champion wrestler, who went to Oxford, burst out crying, wept his eyes out, and from that day on, he starts to get better. Here's a life this day was what a brilliant act of love. Because you understood what that poor young monk thought. All these people caring for me, working for me, sacrificing for me. He was trying so hard to get better out of gratitude. That was making him sick. You understand? If you try too hard to get better, it makes you sick. Brilliant psychology. Because actually the monks are Buddhism is very good on psychology. For example, there's this woman. She'd be coming to our temple so often, but her husband just wouldn't come. And you know, if you're married together, you want to share things with your partner. And it was so important to her, and she knew it was really good. She knew her husband would really love it if he only could read a book or see something. So she came to me very frustrated. Every time she said, "Oh, come to the temple," she said, "No, there's a lot of old, lazy, bald-headed, they should get a proper job, they're just sponging off society, that's just all superstition, I'm not getting any religion." He'd be, you know, like that. So she came to me one day, and I said, "Look, it's so easy. Don't tell your husband to get to the temple. Just take one of my books like this, or come to see me." She actually took this book. And I said, "Leave it around the house, but tell your husband, this is my book, keep your hands off." Obvious. But of course, you know what happened. She left it there. "Keep your hands off, husband." When she was out, of course, he picked it up and he read it from cover to cover. Now he comes every week. Yes, all the time. Easy to do. I told this story of Birken Monastery because in a monastery, you have an abbot who's usually a boss. I don't know who you think is in charge of your marriage or who's in charge of your work office. If you want to get your own way, this is how it's done. Because when I started off in my monastery in Australia, I was number 2 monk, and another monk was senior to me. Those of you who remember him, Ajahn Chakra. Whenever I wanted to, because I was a builder at that time, I learned how to build, not just laying bricks, but build the whole thing. I would suggest to him one day, "Why don't you build a hut on the hill over there?" He would reply, "That's a stupid idea, don't be ridiculous." This is how I started. I wouldn't argue. I said, "Okay," I'd drop it. Because I know once I'd said it, he had heard it, it had got in, it just needed time to be processed, that's all. Usually I would reinforce it in about 2 weeks' time when I knew he'd completely forgotten about it. I'd be walking with him and I'd say, "Why don't you build a hut over there?" The second time he'd say, "Don't be ridiculous, that's a stupid idea." The important thing is, don't argue. And it always would happen, maybe I'd do it a third time, but usually 2 times was enough. I'd be walking with him one day, and he'd suddenly say, "You know, I think we should build a hut over there." And I'd say, "That's a wonderful idea of yours, Ajahn." I knew where it came from. If you have a good idea, you don't need to push it that hard. Any person who knows the psychology of advertising means you just put the message in there and you leave it to ferment. If it's a good idea, it will germinate and it will grow. You only need to maybe reinforce it 1 or 2 times. So if you want a new dress, say, you say to your husband, "No, I need a new dress." He says, "We can't afford it." "Shut up." After 2 weeks, say it again. "Oh, you know, I need a new dress. The nice sale on over the shops over there." "I can't afford it." "Don't we? You've got enough dresses already." "Shut up." And it always works because it goes in his head. It goes around, if it really is a good idea, if we really do need a new dress, he will think of it himself. The important thing with bosses is it has to be their idea. At least it has to seem like it's their idea. The trick is, it's your idea, but putting it in there and convincing them that they thought of it first. That's good psychology. Very practical. You get your own way without getting to arguments. As long as it is a good idea. That works with teenagers as well. Don't you know this? It works with adults as well. There's one occasion, I needed a vice president for our committee of our monastery. We always have committees and things. And there's this one lady, she's a very brilliant lady, had her own company. I thought she would be really good for our Buddhist society. So I approached her one day. "I'm thinking of actually inviting you onto our committee as our vice president." She said, "No, I'm so busy. You know, I've got so much work to do, I've got my plan to look after, I just can't do it." So straight away I realised I had to use psychology to get her on our committee. So I said, "Oh, I never realised that. Look, I know how you are, you're such a kind lady. I think you might feel guilty about this, so I'm going to ban you from my committee this year." You can't go on our committee. Don't even think about it. You are forbidden, verboten, okay? Don't even think about it. You can't come on our committee. 2 days later, she wrote back, why can't I come on your committee? She fell right into it. She became a vice president. And she always goes, oh, that had to have love. Keep clear of him. You can just do whatever you want with him. With anybody. So, what is psychology? But it's also just the psychology of learning how to deal with, like, the death, the sickness of other people and yourself, with a beautiful sense of peace, acceptance, love, which is helpful, which can even cure those sicknesses, and understanding the meaning of life. Go off my house, I hope you, no matter who you are. Do you understand that? I will test you now to see if you do. There's an old Buddhist story, which is also in my book. Well, the seven monks. The story of the seven monks goes like this. There were seven monks who were meditating on loving kindness in a cave in the jungle a long time ago. It's important you remember who the seven monks were, so please listen carefully. The first monk was the head monk, the second monk was his brother, the third monk was his best friend. The fourth monk was his enemy. They just had personality clashes. They just couldn't get along. The fifth monk was a very old monk, so advanced in years, he could die any day. The next monk was a very ill and sickly monk. And actually, no one could know who would die first, the old monk or the sick monk. They were both very, very close to death. And the last monk, the seventh monk, was the useless monk. Whenever he tried to meditate, he'd snore. Whenever he chanted, he always chanted out of key. And he couldn't even keep his robes on properly. And one day, this gang of thieves, robbers, found that cave in the jungle. They wanted to take it over as their headquarters, their hideout, where they could put all of their loot from their robberies and hide away from the authorities. But, of course, they couldn't let all the monks go because the monks would tell the authorities where the cave was located and they'd all be caught. So they insisted on killing all of the monks. Now, the head monk was a very good speaker. Don't ask me how. He managed to convince the head of the robbers to let all the monks go except for one who had to be sacrificed so the rest of the monks could go free. So the question is, which monk did the head monk sacrifice? Now listen, who the seven monks were. Head monk, the brother, the best friend, the enemy, the old monk, the sick monk. Old monk and sick monk were about to die anyway. And lastly, the useless monk, who his whole life had never done anything for anybody. So who did the head monk choose? Any suggestions? Please have the courage to put your hand up if you agree with that himself. Put your hand up. You are all wrong. I love doing that. So that's the wrong answer. Any other suggestions?
Enemy.
Enemy? No.
His brother.
Nobody. Brother?
No. Nobody.
The useless monk. How many times does the useless monk get a mention? That's what I'll Paul say. The answer is, somebody has heard it before. The answer is, there was no way he could choose. Now listen to this. The reason I'll tell this story, I'll explain in a moment, but I'll tell you the answer first of all. His love for his brother was exactly the same, no more, no less, than his love for his best friend. No more, no less, than his love for his enemy. He loved them all equally. He even loved the old monk, the sick monk, and the useless monk, exactly the same as everybody else. And most importantly, and also profoundly, his love for each of his six fellow monks was no more, no less, than his love for himself. Isn't it the golden rule in the Christian Bible to love your neighbor as yourself? It doesn't say to love your neighbor more than yourself. To love your neighbor as yourself means to love yourself as your neighbor. No more, no less. In Buddhism, we call this unconditional loving kindness. The door of my heart is open to all beings, including yourself. The reason why I tell this story, in all Western countries, people usually suggest that he sacrificed himself. What that answer means is that your love towards yourself is not equal to your love towards others. You are much more critical of yourself, much more demanding of yourself, much more unforgiving of yourself than you are to others. That is one of the reasons why people have lack of self-esteem, why they have problems in the Western world. If you can only consider yourself no more, no less than all other beings, to treat yourself equally, to say to yourself as you can say to others, the door of my heart is open to me. As I am, whatever I've done, whoever I am, the door of my heart is open. That is a very cathartic moment in a person's life, to make peace with themselves, and especially to make peace with their history. If you'll find there's part of you which you've kept outside, the part you're not proud of, the part you don't like, as long as that stays outside, you'll never be whole, you'll never be free. You'll never learn how to love yourself, and so you never really know what it means to love another. Really. As soon as you can accept yourself, you'll be able to show that same love to others. Unconditional love and kindness. The door of my heart is open to all beings. You will then love your neighbor as yourself, and love yourself as your neighbor. Be forgiving, accepting, that's why I tell that story. And it is based on an old story from the time of the Buddha, the story of Adimuttatera. I've changed it slightly, but the end of the story is when the head monk explained he could make no choice and explained why, as I've just explained to you. The head of these thieves was so impressed, as were all the other thieves. Not only did they let all the monks go, but they all became monks themselves. Now that is an exaggeration, because in a story, half of them returned to the village, and half of them did become monks. Not all of them, only half. But it does show the power of such a teaching. How it can not only liberate yourself, but liberate others. And so loving yourself is just looking at that brick wall, saying, yeah, you've got 2 bad bricks. You've also got 998 other bricks as well. And to complete that story, to complete the whole part of today's talk, I once gave that story of the 2 bad bricks to a group of people suffering from cancer, a cancer group. At the end of my talk, a builder came up and said, please don't feel so disappointed you made mistakes. Even professional bricklayers make mistakes. But he added a secret of the building industry. He said, in the building industry, when we make a mistake like that, we call it a feature. And we charge our clients an extra $2,000 for it. So if you've got a house which has got a special feature, it started off as a mistake. What a beautiful ending to that story, because once we understand this beautiful feeling of love, that all my house opens everything, you'll find the mistakes in your life, the time which comes to you from time to time, is a feature. And it does add value to your life. It does add the sweetness to the apples. It adds the fragrance to the flowers. This is a positive message. This is a straight down the line Buddhist message or spiritual message. It works. It's not just positive thinking. It's powerful. And it will keep you happy and content for a long, long time. If you're happy and content, You don't come and worry me, it gives me a peaceful life. So thank you for listening to some of the stories from opening the door of your heart, otherwise known as who ordered this truckload of dark.
Benyon book, you talked about a beautiful, beautiful moving story that really emphasized the doors of my heart open to you. That woman who was physically abused by your husband, would you tell the others? It's so beautiful.
Okay, this is an extremely powerful book. I don't recommend this as a strategy for an ordinary person. This was a special woman. Many years ago, maybe about 10 years ago, she came to see me after a talk. I noticed her in our regular crowd at our Buddhist center in France. But this was the first time she came to say hello. She said that she'd been coming for 7 years. When she first came, it was not because she was interested in Buddhism or religion, nor was she interested in meditation. The only reason she came was because 2 hours in our temple was 2 hours when she wasn't being hit by her husband. She was a woman suffering from extreme domestic abuse and violence. At that time, there was not support structures in place. It was one of these hidden problems of society which were not being addressed. And you can imagine, I don't know if any of you have been so unfortunate and lucky to experience such things. As a woman, you are completely confused, in emotional turmoil, because you just do not know what to do or where to turn. It's easy to look on the outside and say, you should leave. But when you're in the middle of this, you just cannot see straight at all. But when she did come to our center, she heard something called positive forgiveness. Positive forgiveness means this: you forgive all the faults of that person. But not just that. That's not enough. The positive side means every time her husband did something she could respect, could like, she would shower him with hugs and kisses, praise him, give positive encouragement to even the smallest act of kindness. Forgive the violence and to positively reinforce any civilized behavior from that monster. When she said this, she had wet eyes and so did I. I was about to cry when she said it took 7 long years. In those 7 years, she changed her monster of a husband into being the most caring and sensitive man you can imagine. They had 2 beautiful children, and when she smiled, she was like an angel, saying she had this wonderful relationship with this man. She had transformed. Whatever happiness she has, she deserves everything. She made it. That was an extreme example which you cannot say everyone can do. It was a dangerous thing what she did. She could have been killed. But nevertheless, that's what she did. And it shows what is possible in life. I don't know what your relationship is. Positive reinforcement is very powerful. Forgiving the faults of another, but reinforcing the positive qualities by kisses, hugs, whatever it is, some praise, something the other person likes, a reward. You find that that is incredibly powerful in any relationship, and it's beautiful when it works. She could have left, and that man would have probably married someone else. Then revisited that violence on the next lady he married or lived with. In Buddhism, next life he'd probably done the same. That woman helped him see a different way of living, of being sensitive and kind. And she made him see that with this beautiful, positive forgiveness. What a wonderful woman that was. In my life, she's up there with one of my favorite women. Not because she looks beautiful on the outside, she's old now, because she's got this beautiful heart. She changed a monster into being her prince. You know that old story of the person who finds his frog? A spell has been put on me. Once you kiss me, I will change into this beautiful prince. That's what she did. She had a frog of a husband, and she kissed him with positive forgiveness. Over 7 years, he turned into this beautiful prince. The spell of evil, if you like, had been removed through kindness. That's the metaphor of our fairy tale. Isn't that what it means? If you've got no choice, sometimes you can do that with anybody. Your husband, your wife may not be that bad. Sometimes you think they are, but they're not really. Come on. But whatever positive qualities you see in them, reinforce them. Say how much you appreciate that, how much you love that. Don't ever take any goodness in your partner for granted. Any stupidity, just forgive it. Don't reinforce the bad by arguing, by complaining. You find that way you change your partner. That way you change yourself. You change your kids. Okay, question number one. Thank you. Any second question? Yeah.
Could you say something about the concept of no self?
No self. That's a difficult one, but it goes like this. This is that deep winter. The simile I've given of the driverless bus. Using a metaphor of life being a journey, in this case, a bus journey. And in this bus journey, sometimes your vehicle goes through some very difficult times. It's like going through some very ugly territory. Like going to the US, for example. And you say, oh, please, can I get out of here as soon as possible? Please. Speed up! And often when you go into some very ugly territory, the bus driver slows down, even stops. The suffering and pain of your life seem to last more than they should. At other times in life, you go into the most beautiful scenic territory, like driving through Vancouver. And when you're driving through some beautiful scenery, you tell the bus driver, please slow down. Stop, I want to enjoy the scenery even longer. And that's the pleasant times in life. But so often the pleasant times in life don't last as long as they should. So after a while you want to find out this bus driver, your will, choose, and get it straight. Whenever there's pain, please avoid those areas, or get out as soon as possible, but please don't linger there. When you have happiness, please may it last longer. You want to train yourself to try and have more happiness and less suffering. But to be able to train yourself, the one in charge, you've got to find the bus driver's seat, first of all. The seat of your will. Find out who is in charge and sort them out. And in meditation, to cut a long story short, you finally find the seat of your will. The origin of all this choosing. Who is in charge? And in meditation you can get a great shock, a profound insight. The bus driver's seat is empty. There's no one at the controls. Basically, you're out of control, sir. And the sooner you realize that, the better. Because then when you see there's no one to complain to, you just sit down and shut up. You stop complaining about life. And you find the more you stop complaining, the more you have pleasant scenery and the less unpleasant scenery. That's Hanukkah in a nutshell. The simile of the driverless bus. You ask any neuroscientist, any modern psychologist, they'll say the same. Will is a process, not a being. Okay, next question. Any question? Going, yeah, but I'll just go in there.
There's a question about teenagers and drug use.
Yeah.
In our family, we have two boys that have struggled with that and continue to struggle with that. And we've tried intervention, confrontation, kind of, in the case of one boy, it's now being taken off our hands, but he's probably going to go to jail.
Yeah.
And we can't seem to...
Yeah. Again, you try positive reinforcement, which is reinforcing his non-drug taking abilities. One of the important things with teenagers is to empower them to make decisions, because when you always tell them what to do, you finally weaken their resolve, and they do what their peers want them to do. A lot of drug taking is because of peer pressure. And to actually to resist that, you've got to have that inner strength. You do what you think is right. Don't do what mom and dad say is right. Because you have to have that inner strength to make your own decisions. To stand up for what you really think is right. With that inner strength, the people can have the ability to withstand their peers. If they submit to their parents, they submit to their peers. From the problems. The one problem with growing children, especially with a mother, there's nothing wrong with you, this is what mothers are like. That we worry about and we control them. You can't let them go that easily. This is the problem. So when you have children, remember they're not your children. They're just yours for a while. In Buddhism we say they come from another life. And they come through your womb into your life. You care for them, you look after them, you nurture them, and then you have to let them go. You do your very best. Then you let them go. It's like keeping a bird in a cage. If you keep a bird in a cage with the cage door shut, sooner or later that cage door is going to be open. The bird will fly away and never come back. That's a control freak. If you keep a bird in a cage, but if that cage door is always open, the bird can fly away whenever it wants. But it's a beautiful cage with lots of nice food and a very caring owner. The bird will always come back. You don't need a cage. They want to come back. That's actually how to look after a loved one, whether it's a partner, whether it's a child. Give them something. And this is a story. This is not in this book, this is my meditation book. About not controlling. Because sometimes people try to control their mind. Remember, I said, don't control it. Once they go, let it go, it'll come back. Because there was this young child in Australia who was about 6 years of age. He got upset with his mummy and said, "Mummy, I want to leave home." So he's six. So his mother said, "Okay." And went to the bedroom and helped the child pack his bags. Made the child some sandwiches and waved him off at the door. Bye-bye. The little child went down the road, maybe 100 yards, turned around and came back again into his waiting mother's arms. What a beautiful, trusting mother that was. I told that to, when I was taking that to a Singapore girl, she burst out laughing because that was saving up to her when she was five. She got really fed up with her mother saying, "I'm leaving home." "You have to you as well." Okay, there you go. Very good motherhood, that is. In this particular case, the mother actually, she's been in Singapore, she had no time to face the sandwiches, gave her $20. Here's $20, bye-bye. So this little five-year-old, little man, little Kenny, went down the elevator, down to the bottom, and then straight back up the elevator again, to her mother. If you let them go, they'll always come back. Because look at five-year-old, six-year-old, they love their home. They love their mum and their dad. They always come back. They say, "Okay, come back." There we go. If you say no and get angry at them, then when they do go, they go to heaven sometimes. That's a very smart way of giving freedom to the ones you love. Obviously, if it's a difficult neighborhood, you don't do that when there's these deviant freaks around who abuse kids. But, with a bit of care, you can do that. Okay, now I'm going to open the door of my mouth to myself because it's my lunch time. So I'm going to have lunch now, and afterwards we're going to have a session of questions and answers afterwards. So please enjoy your lunch, and afterwards we'll continue on after lunch. Very good. What is mindfulness? Okay. If you look at the mind, there's two parts of the mind. This is just one way of looking at it, but it's a very useful framework. The first part of the mind is the passive part of the mind. That which just knows, receives the information, can see, can hear, can know, without reacting. The second, I call that the knower, or mindfulness, if you like. The second part of the mind is the active part of the mind, which actually reacts, thinks, does, initiates any response to what you are experiencing. That's the active part of the mind. A lot of times, because we spend all of our energy reacting, doing things, thinking, managing, planning, remembering, working everything out, always reacting to life, we have very little energy left just for pure knowing, for pure mindfulness. And because of that, our ability to know is very weak. We think that we are aware, but our awareness has got very little power. In meditation, you tend to not react, not do so much, not think, not plan, not manage anything. You don't react to whatever you experience. That's part of meditation. Just be still, don't react. What happens then is the energy of your mind, instead of going into reacting, managing, doing, can now all flow into mindfulness. Mindfulness becomes empowered. You literally wake up. You see more deeply. Even colors you see are more rich, more vivid. For example, I told this story yesterday at Broken. The very first meditation retreat which I took was still as a student in Cambridge. We hired a boarding house, which was usually for students in the vacation period. Now many of you know that one of the things England isn't famous for, or is rather infamous for, is its food. Even at the best of the times, the English people don't know how to cook. And the worst of the whole heap is in boarding houses for poor students. So I was not looking forward to the meals during this retreat. Usually they had three-course meals. Stodge, stodge, and stodge. And it all tasted the same. However, during this retreat, I was very surprised that all the meals were delicious. They tasted nice. At the time, I thought we must have struck lucky and got the best boarding house cook in the whole of England. However, I soon realized that was not the case. The food was delicious, not because of the cook. The food was delicious because my mind was more empowered with mindfulness. I was literally tasting more deeply the few flavors which were actually there. I was making more of what we had. And that is what happens when you empower mindfulness. Also, that retreat was a strange experience. We were allowed to go for a walk every morning for 1 hour. Exercise was supposed to be. But every morning, I knew Cambridge because that's where I was living. I was a student there. I went to the botanical gardens, which were very close by. I thought I'd have a nice walk there, exercise, but I only got to the entrance, and at the entrance was this beautiful clump of bamboo. It was so entrancing, I could not go past. I stood enchanted just by the slender shape and the rich green of the stalks, and the way the whole thing just curved, just so beautifully, and how the whole thing swayed in the morning breeze. It was absolutely gorgeous. And I was looking at it for about 10 or 15 minutes when I saw a bench nearby, sat down, and gazed in awe in the most beautiful clump of bamboo I'd ever seen in the whole world. I had to tear myself away to go back to the meditation retreat. For 8 of the 9 mornings, I went back to the most beautiful Kapalabhati in the world. I never finished with exploring its transcendent beauty. When the retreat had finished, when I was back studying, I had a 3 afternoon off, maybe 2 or 3 weeks later. I decided to get on my bicycle and go and see my friend, the most beautiful Kapalabhati in the world. I got to the front of the botanical gardens. I saw this spindly, dirty, most uninteresting, boring clump of bamboo you could ever see. And that's what I wondered, what was going on? And I realized when you're under a tree, your mind is so still. Your mindfulness increases so much. It becomes empowered. You can see just an ordinary clump of bamboo built out of the most beautiful, amazing thing in the whole world. You can actually literally see more. Feel more, see richer and more beauty. 2 or 3 weeks later, I was rushing around as usual like a student, cycling through busy Cambridge traffic. But by the time I saw that bamboo, what I saw when my mind was still, I could not see now. Now this is an interesting thing about mindfulness. Because we rush around so much, our mindfulness is so weak. We can hardly see anything. What we see, you can't see the beauty, the richness in it. That's why if you go on a retreat, you really get into deep meditation, you go back home, your wife looks so beautiful. She always was, but you just too dull to see it. And your husband, oh, he's so nice. That's why, if you're having marital problems, send him on a retreat, we'll look after it. So this is actually mindfulness. It's how it sees deeper into things. So not only do you get more understanding of life, but you also see more beauty in life as well. And that's an interesting part, which not many monks actually emphasize. The more still you are, the more beautiful life is. You appreciate them. Another simile which is similar. My monastery is on top of a hill, 2 kilometers from the bottom to the summit. For 9 years, when I've been in that monastery, I've been going up and down that monastery in a vehicle. One day, I decided, just for exercise, because it was a beautiful morning, I asked the driver, please drop me off at the foot of the hill. I will walk up and I'll see you later on this morning. So I walked up that hill. As I was walking up that hillside, what amazed me was I could not recognize my surroundings. I was walking up a completely different hill to the one I recognized. And that really astounded me. Look, I've been up and down that hill for 9 years. How come I can't recognize what I'm now seeing while I'm walking? So I stopped. When I stopped still, the hillside changed again. I saw more deeply every blade of grass and rock. It was so beautiful in its detail and the richness of its colour. Being a scientist, I wanted to work out what was happening. I realised that when you're looking through the window of a speeding car, the light does not have a chance to form a proper image on your retina at the back of your eye. Before more light comes, the story is old, and you have to go and see a new image. Things change so fast that no image has a chance to properly form. And the mind doesn't have a chance to explore this washed out image which is there on your retina. You're going too fast to know. And what you see is not fully developed. You lack the richness, the texture, the detail. What's in the outlet? If you slow down, your eye, say, has more chance to form a proper picture. There's more details and the colours are richer. If you stop, only then you have all the time in the world for the image out there to fully form and for the mind to explore it to its depth. Which is why when I stopped, I saw much more. I saw all these incredible details. And literally, the grass was greener. The rocks had more texture to them. And any flowers, any yellows, were more rich, more deep, more incredibly beautiful. because they have all the chance to form an image on my mind. And that was a great metaphor for mindfulness and its benefits in life. We are going so fast that we live our life as if looked through a window of a speeding car. No wonder we don't really know about life. Sometimes we think you know your partner. You're moving from one thing to another so fast. Sometimes you don't even know them. You could just slow down and stop. You'll see much more. You'll feel more deeply. And you will taste the more delicious flavors of life. You're slowing down from being fully mindful. Mindfulness becomes empowered. And everything becomes richer. The dullness of life is replaced by this incredible depth of color. Amazing texture of life. You literally feel, hear more. If ever you go out to an expensive restaurant for a meal, always meditate beforehand so you get your money's worth. Is that what you're not looking forward to? Is that a question?
Yes, but is there any kind of a tip or any kind of an idea to think that somebody could start from wherever they are to achieve higher level of mindfulness?
Yes, just do less, go slower, spend time in the moment. Present moment awareness is powerful. So you don't always have to be doing things. Even when you go to work in the morning, we've got these great meditation teachers at every crossroad. We call them red traffic lights. They're telling you to stop. So when you do stop at the red traffic light, not just the car stop, please may you stop as well. This is a story in the book, I've heard in India, though I haven't seen it myself yet, that in the red lights, when they turn red, they don't spell S-T-O-P. They spell the letters R-E-L-A-X. Relax. They're not stop lights, they're relax lights. If you haven't got those yet in Vancouver, please approach the mayor and say, look, to lessen the stress in this great city and to make sure it gets number one next year as well in the cities list of the world, change all the red traffic lights into relax lights. So when people are on the way to work, they see this amazing signal when they get the red light. Relax. I'm glad that you couldn't get Michael. Great idea, isn't it? No, I'm serious. Try and do it. Does anyone know anyone in the council in there? It's actually day to day, so maybe they should have put it in their manifesto. But people do get stressed out on the way to work. And it's crazy. So, don't have to relax much. You can do much more. You're more efficient. And you last much longer. Unfortunately, in the Western society, the only people who rest in peace are in the graveyard. Oh, what a shame. I want to RIP before I die. Yeah.
Can you kindly explain how concepts of rebirth, what will be done and get reborn again, what do you carry to the next birth, or how is it?
Okay, one of the stories in this book, here's a story of the man with the four wives. It's an old story from a long time ago. Once there was a man who had four wives. When he was very old and close to death, he was afraid of going to death alone. So one or two days before he died, he asked his fourth wife, the one who was the most beautiful and attractive, the one he'd married late in life, to come into the room. This woman was very, very beautiful and attractive. And she opened the doors to much of high society and got invitations to amazing events. He asked her in and said, "Darling, I love you very much. Soon I will die, I'll be lonely without you. Would you come with me? And she said, what? I'm not going to die with you. No way. And he was so upset with her response, get out. So he asked his third wife then. His third wife, he also married late in life, but before his fourth wife. She also made many things possible for him in life. And she was also incredibly attractive, so much so that many other people coveted her and wanted her. But she was his. So he asked her in and said, darling, I love you so much. I'm about to die. Will you come with me into death? And she said, no, I will arrange a lavish funeral for you, but after you die, I'll go with your son.
What?
You shameless, I'm not even dead yet. And you already tell me about your infidelity. Get out. He still had two wives left. He asked his second wife to come in. His second wife wasn't all that attractive. He married her, he didn't know when, it was such a long time ago. And his second wife was the one who was his counselor, the one he could always rely on for good advice and for help in times of crisis. She was a very helpful person for him. So he asked her in and said the same thing. Darling, I'm about to die. I'll be lonely without you. Please, will you come with me? And she wrote to him with a lot of pathos and said, I would like to, but I can't. I will speak your praises at your funeral, but I can go no further. Get out, he said. And he called in his first wife. His first wife, he didn't know, couldn't remember the time she wasn't there. And actually, his first wife was the one who was the power behind the scenes. She was really the one who made everything possible for him in his life. And so he called her in and asked her the same question. Darling, I'm about to die. I'll be lonely without you. Will you come with me? And she said, of course, darling. I always go with you from life to life. Otherwise, why would my name not be Mrs. Karma? Mrs. Karma goes with you from life to life. The second wife, who will only speak your praises at the funeral, the one who's your advisor and good friend, is called Mrs. Family. They can speak your praises at the funeral, but they can go no further. The third wife you've got late on in life, the one who made many things possible, the one who other people coveted, but the one who will go with your son when he dies is called Mrs. Well. And the last wife, the one who got last of all, which opened up many doors into society, was called Mrs. Fame, which you get later on in life. And the moral of that story is that when you die, Mrs. Fame can't go with you, neither can Mrs. Well or even Mrs. Family. Only Mrs. Karma can go with you from life to life. So the life of this story is to say, well, you can take with you. So afterwards, make sure you look after your very first wife or your very first husband. They're the one who really counts. Because they will go with you from life to life. And the simple story, which is great for kids, actually big kids as well, your age, because it's very easy to remember. And it's true that that's what happens. It's the inclinations of our life. Our karma, our goodness, that goes with us from life to life. If you don't believe that, as I said, it's important yesterday. If anyone doesn't believe in rebirth, please don't worry about it, because you certainly will believe in rebirth in your next life. Did that answer your question? So as I go around. Okay. Next question. As soon as the questions run out, I'm getting the car and going to Seattle. How many other questions have we got? Yeah.
So, then on a really practical, everyday level, when you meet someone who is beautiful, compassionate, kind, you know, who has all those qualities, and they haven't actually even, they may not even know that they're on a path, or know, is that from their past lives, or is that...
Okay, this is another story about karma, which will answer your question and take it deeper. I don't know if I've mentioned this before in Vancouver, but it's the story of the two people baking a cake. It's a very good story because it explains the Buddhist idea of the law of karma and actually some of the misunderstandings of that law. Again, I put this in a story because it makes it easier to remember and it makes it very clear. There were two women baking a cake. The first had very bad ingredients. They had white flour. They had kept the flour for so long they had to pick out the green bits of mould from the flour before they could use the oven. They had butter which was cholesterol enriched. They had unhealthy white sugar. And the fruit which they had to use was so hard they were considering selling it to the US Army as hard as depleted uranium. And the kitchen which they had to use was pre-World War. Which World War was a matter of debate. It was very odd. They had the very worst ingredients. The second woman had the very best ingredients. They had organically grown whole wheat flour, grown in a place with no GM crops for 1,000 miles around. And they had trans fat free canola oil with beautiful honey from BC and local fruit. And they had the most modern kitchen to cook in. They had the very best ingredients. Now the question is, which woman baked the most delicious cake? It's not always the person with the best ingredients, because the ingredients don't determine always the quality of the final product. It also depends on how you use those ingredients. The amount of care, skill, for want of a better word, love, which you put into your cake. And it often happens that the person with the worst ingredients bakes the most delicious cake. In this simile, the ingredients which you have to bake with is the results of your past karma. That provides the ingredients of your life. However, the most important part of your life is not what you have to work with, but what you're doing with what you've got. And it's very often the case that somebody with the very worst ingredients, who are not particularly beautiful, not talented, you know, not intelligent even, at least not good at school, even with the very worst ingredients can make the most amazing cake, make the most amazing person. While other people, and I've known such people, who have been beautiful, talented, intelligent, wealthy parents, because they don't make use of those ingredients, they waste them, they turn out to be terrible people. You may know people. I know a friend of mine, we went to Cambridge together. He was very popular. He was studying medicine at Cambridge. Very popular, good parents. Became a heroin addict. Wasted his whole life. The last I heard, he just was gardening to get by. Could have been a famous doctor, helping others with a very good livelihood. He had a beautiful ingredients, but wasted them. And there are other people who had terrible ingredients, who made a wonderful life. Look at, say, Nelson Mandela, for example. He didn't get born in a wealthy family, go to a big university, but look what an amazing person he became. He went to jail, was it 26 years? So karma is not just the ingredients which you have to deal with in life, that's your past karma. The most important part of karma is what you're doing with it now. And you can bake a delicious cake out of almost anything. That's a lot of karma. So usually when people start to complain about their problems, their difficulties, their children, their husband, their job, their health. Yeah, that's your old karma. Now, what do you do with that? This is what we say, digging that top of the plant. You can make a beautiful garden out of the most disgusting ingredients. You should always remember, whenever you taste those very sweet apples, always remember what you're tasting. Cowship transformed. Look what an apple is. Please remember where it came from. And then it gives you inspiration and hope. Does that answer the question about karma? And this is not just theoretical, it's actually accurate, but it also gives you hope and direction in life. It gives you an opportunity to direct others. So you don't say, oh, it's my karma, I can't do anything. Surely, grievous is your karma. Now, make some good karma out of it. There's always something you can do with anything in life.
What is, though, that determines how you get to that point where you use your ingredients? What are the points? What is it that makes you? Some people have do it and some people don't. Some people relax and say, okay, that's my karma. Some people go ahead and have great jobs. Remember?
Yeah. So the reason why you do this is you buy my book. So all you have, you know, you listen to these talks, you get some positive people around you, it's encouraging. So it's that positivity of life. And really, that is what religion is always supposed to be doing. Religion should not be the negative influence in life, complaining, and always being offended. I always said that of all people in this world, religious leaders should be the hardest to offend. You can call me whatever you like, and I will not get offended, because more than your words is forgiveness and love. Leadership is what's needed. Leadership, encouragement, example. And when we have that encouragement, I don't just say these things, but things, wrong things happen to me, then I make use of them. Okay, let's see what we can do about this. And when we lead by example, and we cite examples, it gives encouragement, hope, direction to everybody in life.
So, in other words, you're saying that some people can accomplish, or achieve, or whatever the word is, around with their ingredients because they had some role models and leadership around them?
Correct. They had encouragement, role models, leadership. They had hope. They realized it could be done. So they went along, okay, I've seen other people do this. Let's do it. And you do it. It's amazing. That's how you can turn the worst experiences in life into something so beautiful. Honestly, you can't change life. You'll get some, you know, some pain in life. You know, there are accidents happen, people die, there are tsunamis, there are hurricanes. But instead of complaining about it, well, why is this happening? Why are there tsunamis? Why are there hurricanes? Instead of complaining about it, say, well, this is our ingredient. Let's stop complaining, let's start painting beautiful cake. And when you see people like that, and they do exist, those are the people who give inspiration and hope. That is the way out of the suffering of life. Yeah.
What about also working with wholesome states of mind and
Oh yeah, with a wholesome state of mind, you have wholesome states of mind. In other words, having a good time, no problems. Please don't take it for granted. This is one of the problems, isn't it? There's this whole story in the book again. About this young emperor who became the king of a realm. But whenever life was good, he spent his time having parties and celebrations. And because of that, the good times never lasted all that long, because he wasn't doing any work, he was just celebrating all the time. And when things started going wrong in his kingdom, he would start getting depressed, stay in his room all day. And of course, he never worked. So actually, and because of that, the bad times lasted longer than usual. And the ministers in his government realize you can't actually tell a king what to do. You've got to be a bit more sensitive or than that, just by telling him directly. So they met together in private. How can we help our king? And suddenly came up with this great idea of giving a ring, a finger ring, to the emperor. A simple gold ring, except for the inscription on the outside, which was, "This too will pass." They presented their king with this ring, told him to wear it on all occasions and reflect on its meaning. But what that meant, that when they were having a good time, when things were going well in the kingdom, the economy was booming, where their hockey team was winning all the matches, they'd look at their ring, "This too will pass." They never took it for granted. And because of good times, he knew they would pass, he worked hard even in prosperity, which meant that the prosperous times lasted longer than they were expected to last. And when things went bad, they're having a terrible time in the country, "This too will pass." It gave him hope, so he never got that depressed. He also worked hard. And because of that, the bad times never lasted that long. He became a very successful emperor. And the moral of that story is, when the bad times happen, this too will pass. Don't last forever. Remember that, that gives you hope, so you never get that depressed. You keep on going. Even like the pain of a divorce. It will pass. You see with other people, 1 or 2 years, it will pass. You'll find someone else and have another relationship. Hopefully a better one next time. And that gives you hope, so you never get that depressed that you stop working in your life. But most importantly, say you've just been divorced and you get this with another partner. Remember, this too will pass. So don't take them for granted. Work hard at your relationship every moment, even if you don't think there's a problem. Because there is a problem underneath it, or it will pass. So you work hard, even in the good times. And then you find the good times last longer than anybody else expected. Because we take our happiness for granted, it disappears too quickly. You know your happiness will pass. You're always guarded like an important treasure. It does last longer. Another simile, Rajan Shah's, he would hold up a cup like this and he'd tell us, "Can you see the crack in it?" We look at him, "What do you mean a crack? I've not seen a crack in this." And he said, "There is a crack in it, but it's invisible. It's there. And one day somebody will drop it or knock it over and the crack will manifest. It will smash and break." He said, if you didn't have that crack there to begin with, if this was unbreakable plastic, then you would not need to care about it. You could kick it, you could drop it, because it was unbreakable. Because it's going to crack one day, that's why you have to care for it. In the same way, he said, every person in front of me has a crack in it, called your future death.